Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A name that frequently comes up in our discussion of religious liberty here on the podcast is that of John Locke, an academic most widely known as being one of the key figures in the English Enlightenment and is often referred to as the father of classical liberalism. Unlike the contemporary usage of the term liberal, which is often associated with larger government, classical liberalism was a philosophy promoting greater freedoms and liberties for citizens, specifically in relation to a more centralized control by a monarch. Locke, who lived through most of the 17th century, was concerned a great deal about the nature of governance, and this concern also drove him to write about the issue of religious toleration and religious liberty. Indeed, Locke is frequently cited as a dominant influence on the thinking of America's founding fathers, who drafted the U.S. Constitution and its First Amendment prohibiting the establishment of religion and guaranteeing the right to free exercise. Considering that religious freedom is a topic that we frequently address on this show, most recently with Alan Hursky, I thought it'd be worthwhile to focus on the thinking of Locke. And as luck would have it, one of the scholarly blogs that I frequently visit recently had Locke featured as well. So what better way to probe the thought of John Locke than to invite Dr. Jason Jewell to our program? Jason is the chairman of the Department of Humanities at Faulkner University in Montgomery, Alabama. Dr. Jewell helps to coordinate various programs at Faulkner, including the Western Cultural Heritage Course Sequence and the Faulkner Patristics Project at the V.P. Black School of Bible and Religion. He is also an adjunct scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. And perhaps most importantly for our listening audience, Jason runs a blog called The Western Tradition, where he writes about some of the great books written in Western civilization, as well as providing his thoughts on contemporary life. This blog essentially functions as a free online course to these great books in Western Civ, and I urge you to visit the website. We'll post a link to it up on our website, where you can also find discussion points related to this podcast and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. So please visit that. Jason, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me on, Tony.
Well, first off, I have to ask you a couple introductory questions before we dive into our discussion of Locke. Now, as I was researching your profile, I looked up the history of Faulkner University, and while I originally thought that it was named after William Faulkner, and that's the guy who played Captain Kirk on the original Star Trek, it turns out that this is not the case, right?
That's right, and actually, Tony, of course, it was William Shatner who played Captain Kirk on Star Trek, not William Faulkner.
Oh, yeah? Oh, who's this William Faulkner guy?
He's a pretty important author, writing in the first half of the 20th century, actually a major figure in the history of Southern literature.
Oh. Was he on Star Trek?
Not that I know of. I think he was probably dead by the time Star Trek came on.
Okay. All right. That's okay. So, but the Faulkner University is not named after William Faulkner either.
No, it's not. And that's actually one of the first things that we get from people a lot, because William Faulkner is, you know, the most famous Faulkner out there, but our university was actually named after James Faulkner, who was a major figure in the Alabama state government, chairman of the Board of Education, I believe, back in the day. And he was a great friend of the school when it was still called Alabama Christian College back in the 60s and 70s. And when the school went to a four-year status from two-year in the 80s, they decided to name it after James Faulkner. But it's really interesting because there's another school in the state, a state school named after James Faulkner, and sometimes it confuses the postman, and we get their mail, and they get our mail, and all kinds of things. It's an interesting situation.
Well, you could just maybe call it William Shatner University. I mean,
I think that would clear up some of the confusion. I don't know how the constituency of the school would feel about that.
Yeah, okay. All right. That's cool. Is there a relationship between James Faulkner and William Faulkner that you know of?
Not that I know of. I think it's two completely different families.
Okay. All right. Well, we're not here to talk about the Faulkners. We're here to talk about John Locke, and he's the main focus today. And I understand that John Locke is a pretty big deal in the world of Western cultural heritage. Is that right?
Yeah, I think you could say that. There's probably at least three areas in which Locke is considered sort of a foundational figure in the modern world, and one of those would be in the field of philosophy. He wrote a very important work on epistemology in the 1690s.
Whoa! That's a big fancy word here too. And I'm kind of more of an economist guy, so I don't know all this epistemology and philosophy words. What's epistemology?
Epistemology is a branch of philosophy. It's basically the theory of knowledge or the study of how we know things.
Mm-hmm.
And so Locke writes that it's actually a pretty lengthy work called An Essay Concerning Human Understanding, in which he lays out what's essentially the foundation of the modern philosophy of empiricism, which means that everything we know comes to us through our senses, our five senses. And that was a pretty revolutionary idea at the time. I expect that a great many people would pretty much agree with Locke on that today, but he's basically going against the notion that, you know, we're born with certain knowledge built into us.
Hmm. That's kind of interesting. So what else is he known for?
Okay, well then the second area would be his political philosophy, and here the big work is his second treatise on civil government, which is major influence not only in England, but also in colonial America and on the founding fathers of the United States. And then thirdly, we've got his writings on religion, of which this most famous one is his letter concerning toleration, which is probably what we're going to spend most of our time talking about today, in which he's basically arguing for a sort of what we would call in the modern world a separation of church and state.
Yeah, we do want to talk about that today because we are a podcast that focuses on religion specifically, but I do want to set the context in which Locke was writing here and get a bigger feel for what he was all about. Now, he lived in England from roughly 1632 to 1704, and that spanned a rather interesting and important time in British history. If you could set the historical table for us so that we can better understand what Locke was writing about when he gets to his letter concerning toleration in the late 17th century. What was going on in jolly old England there in the 17th century?
Well, the 17th century is a really interesting time in English history. It's a very tempestuous time. You've got a lot of conflict, and not only in England, but also the entire European continent. You have a lot of warfare going on, much of which is religiously motivated in the 17th century on the continent. For example, you've got the 30 Years' War in the middle of the century, which killed, by some estimates, about half the people in Germany, you know, very destructive conflict, and that's mainly a Roman Catholic versus Protestant fight. In England, you have a couple of big conflicts and revolutions in the 17th century. Going back to the 1640s and 1650s, you've got a civil war between the Parliament on the one side and the King on the other, which ended, the first phase of it ended in 1649 when Parliament wins and they execute King Charles I. And then you have a decade or so where England has no king. You've got a Republican form of government. Oliver Cromwell is sort of running the show during that period. And then a restoration of the monarchy in 1660. And then coming up into the 1680s, around the time when Locke is writing a lot of his works, you have in 1685, a Roman Catholic king, James II, coming to the throne.
And this totally freaks out people in England.
Yeah, very much so, because, of course, the Church of England, the official established church, is a Protestant church, and there are various laws on the books preventing Roman Catholic worship and preventing Roman Catholics from holding various positions in the government. They can't vote in parliamentary elections and so on. And so when James II comes to the throne, you have a real fear on the part of a lot of people that he's going to bring back the days of Bloody Mary, who was Queen of England in the middle of the 16th century, and she's famous for, of course, burning Protestants at the stake, a couple of hundred of those during her brief reign. So you have a lot of concern about this, but then, you know, James reassures them, and I'm not going to go crazy here, and they think that maybe they can get by with this, because after all, James is fairly old when he takes the throne. He's in his mid-50s, which is pretty old in the 17th century.
All right.
And he has two daughters who are both Protestants, and the expectation is, well, you know, he'll be king a few years, he'll die, and then we'll get a Protestant queen on the throne, and everything will be good again. But then James threw off all of those calculations because he had remarried after the death of his first wife. He had remarried a much younger woman who was an Italian princess, another Roman Catholic, and in 1688 she gave birth to a son who would, of course, take precedence in the line of succession over his two older Protestant sisters. So here we have this baby boy who, of course, is going to be raised as a Roman Catholic, and now the English are looking at this prospect of an endless succession of Roman Catholic rulers, and that sort of tips the scales, and you have what's called in English history the Glorious Revolution against James, and it's not only glorious because, from their perspective, the Protestants won, but also because it was actually pulled off with relatively little bloodshed. James didn't really resist that much when the army came over from the Netherlands, led by one of James's daughters, Mary, and her husband William. James pretty much loses his nerve and flees the country, and so they take possession of the country without too much difficulty, and you have a restoration of Protestant rule there in England.
And I'm always fascinated by these tales of the monarchs of not only England but of, you know, other parts of Europe too. Because you know, first of all, you get the Protestant daughters and the dad's a Catholic, and you're wondering, okay, what's that all about? And then, you know, the daughters are basically having a palace coup against their dad. I mean, that's kind of just bizarre stuff going on.
Yeah, the family, the Stuart family, is. I don't want to use the word schizophrenic, that's not the right thing, but they're really conflicted about their religious identity throughout the 17th century. Charles I, James II's father, had married a French princess who was Roman Catholic, and there was a lot of speculation that Charles I was sort of a crypto-Catholic, trying to take England back towards the Catholic Church, away from the Protestantism that it had been kind of settled in for a couple of generations, and that's one of the motivations for that civil war in the 1640s. When Charles is killed and his two sons, Charles, who eventually becomes Charles II, and James, they live in exile in France during this time, and somewhere along the way, James, even though he already has two daughters who have been raised as Protestants, he is an adult convert to Roman Catholicism. James's brother, Charles II, who preceded him as king, was sort of a closet Roman Catholic. That was the perception, at least, for much of his reign. And then on his deathbed, he did go through the rite of, you know, being received into the Roman Catholic Church. So there's a lot of suspicion in the more ardent and fervent Protestants in the country throughout the 17th century that these Stuarts are just trying to undo the Reformation, and there's a lot of distrust of them.
And the religious scene, too, is a little bit more complicated than just Protestants versus Catholics, because the Protestant church, the Anglican church, is one that actually in many ways is modeled upon the Catholic church. Henry VIII basically just says, well, we're going to have our own church here. It doesn't really go through the Calvinist influence that you might see in on the continent. And during the 1600s, and even before then, you're starting to see a lot of religious ferment and dissatisfaction with the Church of England. Is that right?
Yes. The Church of England, like you said, is not really established as a result of any kind of argument over doctrine. It's more of an authority issue back in the 16th century. And there's a lot of back and forth in that period right after Henry VIII. First they're Protestant, and then they're Catholic under Mary, and then they're Protestant again under Elizabeth. But when all is said and done, and Elizabeth, what they call, settled the Church of England with the Act of Uniformity, you have a church that in many respects still looks like the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, they don't change the mode of church government. They still have bishops. All of the same figures who were there, during the Middle Ages. The Archbishop of Canterbury is still the top figure in the church hierarchy, excepting the monarch, of course. And a lot of the ceremonies they retain. They still have a number of things that visually would look much like a Roman Catholic service. And that dissatisfied a lot of the Protestants who were in the more Calvinist mode, the Reformed with a capital R Protestants. And so this is where we have the origins of the Puritan movement that goes through the late 16th and early 17th centuries. The Puritans were within the Church of England trying to reform it further and get it to look more like the Church of Scotland or the churches that you would see in Geneva that were more definitely influenced by Calvinism. But in many respects, the doctrine of the Church of England, if you read the 39 Articles of the Church of England, that founding document, it looks like pretty Protestant doctrine, but there are a lot of ways in which it still looks Roman Catholic, and that bothered a lot of people. So when we get up to the 1640s and we have the Civil War, particularly when it looks like Charles I is trying to, in the minds of a lot of people, turn back the clock to more Roman Catholic stuff, and you have this Civil War, Charles is killed, Oliver Cromwell's in charge. Oliver Cromwell is actually favoring a policy of religious toleration for all Protestants and even Jews. Cromwell allows Jews back into England. It had been the first time since the late 13th century that Jews had been allowed into the country. So during that period, we see the 1650s in particular, we see a lot of groups popping up, coming out of the woodwork that who would have been persecuted under the earlier laws that were on the books. We have people like Baptists coming out for the first time, Quakers. Some of these groups survive into the modern era. Others were sort of flashes in the pan that didn't really go past the 17th century. But we've got people called the Ranters and the Diggers and other kinds of more radical groups that are able to sort of show their faces in public because of this policy of toleration. So that's one of the things that has attracted a lot of modern scholars who are interested in religious pluralism. They like to look at the 1640s and 1650s to see all the what was bubbling under the surface.
And I love the names that come out too, because you got the Ranters, as you mentioned, the Diggers, and you can kind of get an idea of what they were doing based upon their name. And indeed, the Quakers, which were the Society of Friends, they got the name Quaking or Quakers because they actually quake. They had kind of a Pentecostal Holy Spirit coming down and shaking. And I can imagine that would freak out a lot of the members of the established Church of England.
Yeah, the Quakers were actually seen by many people as a really serious threat to the social order. For one thing, that they refused to show any kind of marks of deference to their superiors in social rank. They wouldn't take off their hats in the presence of nobility.
How dare they?
Yeah. But today we think of the Quakers, they're pacifists and they're all really peaceful people. That pacifism doesn't really become a central Quaker doctrine until really the late 1650s, I would guess. And there is a lot of concern during the 1650s that the Quakers might engage in some violent action to overturn portions of the social order. And there's a school of thought out there that believes that the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 was to some extent a response to this perceived threat of the Quakers. That's certainly a debatable proposition. I'm not really convinced of that myself, but certainly it shows that there was a lot of concern on the part of ordinary people that some of these what they would consider religious extremists of that time might have some kind of serious threat to pose to the society.
And that's going to bring us into John Locke, because one of the things that he is going to be arguing against, and we get to this in the Letter of Toleration, is this notion that you need to have uniformity in religion. Because if you don't have uniformity in religion, then you get Quakers and Ranters and Diggers, and they're quaking and ranting and digging, and that will tear the social fabric asunder here. And so this is what he's saying. So let's talk a little bit about John Locke the person now. He's born in roughly 1632, I believe. So he is living through that. Now, he's pretty young when the Civil War is going on, but you hear things, and as I understand it, his dad as well was a member of the Roundheads, or the parliamentarians who were fighting against the king during the English Civil War. So give us a little bit of background about who this John Locke guy is.
Yeah, so he's from a fairly well-to-do family. They do have Puritan sympathies, so yes, they're kind of on the Roundhead side in the Civil War. He is educated at Oxford in the 1650s when he's in his 20s. And he goes through a sort of traditional educational curriculum there. and became, you know, an expert in the Greek language, later became a lecturer at Oxford in Greek, and also got into a lot of philosophy. He was a big fan of Descartes, for example, you know, who's writing in the 1630s and 40s. And when the monarchy is restored in 1660, of course, he is, his family and probably he would have been fairly disappointed by that, but he gets attached to some of the prominent big Protestant figures in the government and is sort of patronized by them and is rewarded with various positions in the government at different times through the 1660s and 70s. He did some traveling, you know, interesting life in a lot of ways. But by the time we get up to the 1670s and 80s, he starts to have some problems. One of his major patrons sort of falls from power in the 1670s, the Earl of Shaftesbury. And you know, in American history, we know Shaftesbury is one of the founders of the colony in South Carolina. And you know, he's an interesting guy in several ways too. But once he's out of power, Locke is kind of recedes from public view a little bit, and he spends a lot of his time writing. So a lot of his most famous works are written really in the 1680s and around up about to 1690, I guess. But he's in ill health by this time, and he winds up taking another position in the government that takes up all of his time in the 1690s. So by the last 10 or 15 years of his life, he doesn't really write anything that we remember today so much. But the 1680s is really that period when he's writing these, what we consider these fundamental works of the modern age.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about his general body of work on governance, and we'll talk more about religious pluralism here in a second. How is he contrasted with, say, some of the earlier philosophers of medieval history? And
okay, well, his assumptions are different in a lot of ways from medieval thinkers. Locke is usually considered to be, you know, a key figure of the early part of the Enlightenment. And, of course, one of the ideals of the Enlightenment is the stress on reason, and not just the use of reason to try to solve problems, because people in the Middle Ages did that. I think there's kind of this misconception that nobody cared about reason, you know, in the ancient world of the Middle Ages. Of course, that's not the case. But the key thing about the Enlightenment is of course, you're relying on unassisted human reason. You're not going to allow your reason necessarily to be influenced by tradition or by even revelation in some cases. And so one of the things that Locke is doing in the 1680s, he's trying to set up this this foundation for civil government and you know, epistemology, like we talked about earlier, in a way that Locke is kind of looking for common ground among people of, you know, whatever their religious persuasion, they could all kind of, hopefully, in his mind, they could all agree on these principles that he was laying out there, that yes, we learn through our senses, or yes, the government exists because we need physical security, or things like that. Things that he thought everybody could agree on, that you wouldn't need necessarily some kind of religious revelation to get to that conclusion.
And so, I mean, he's viewing government a lot differently than the medieval thinkers did.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. You know, the medieval writers, and even the early modern writers, you know, in the 16th and early 17th centuries, for the most part, are part of this tradition that goes all the way back to, you know, Plato and Aristotle, in that they conceive the state as an entity that is supposed to bring the people who are a part of it, you know, closer to the good life, and it's going to help them cultivate virtue. And Locke, when he talks about the state in the Second Treatise, and in the Letter on Toleration, he defines the state as something very differently. He doesn't assign any kind of, you know, transcendent purpose to the state. It's more of an idea of, well, the state is there so that we can all be secure in our property, and that we can all, the individuals can go around pursuing their own interests, and there's no sort of guiding force there that the state is trying to get us to this higher goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to become very important in terms of how he views the relationship of church and state, because one could easily imagine that if you have a conception of governance based upon the need to promote virtue in society, the church, the religious authorities are going to become very closely attached to the state. Whereas if the government is largely providing physical security and maybe some other stuff and junk that you might need, and not so much your spiritual welfare, you don't need to have those two things connected.
Yeah, I think that's true. And if you look at even in the Protestant Reformation, figures like Huldrych Zwingli in Switzerland or Calvin, for that matter, they too would have said we need a separation of church and state, but they would have meant it in a very different way than Locke eventually comes to argue. Because in somebody like Zwingli, his thinking is, okay, well, the state is its own thing. It's an institution that has its job to do. It's supposed to, punish criminals and do those sorts of things. The church has its function. It's supposed to, administer the sacraments and preach the word and so on. But both of these institutions, the church and the state, they're both under God. They're both supposed to be performing the tasks that God has assigned to them. And they cooperate. They work together in accomplishing that. So when the civil government is trying to figure out, what would be good laws to make, and if they're trying to do this in a Christian way, then they would naturally kind of go to the church leaders and say, well, what does the scripture say about such and such, and how might we implement this in law? And the church leaders would give them advice. It doesn't mean that the church leaders are writing the laws. I mean, there's this, with Calvin in particular, you get these people saying, like, oh, John Calvin, he ruled Geneva with an iron fist, in the 1550s, and that's not true at all. We know that Calvin got run out of Geneva by the civil government a couple of times because they didn't like what he was doing. So anything that Calvin wanted to see happen in law, he had to go and persuade the local government to try to do that. But there was an understanding that they would work together because they're both trying to serve God, and they're both trying to, administer kind of a Christian society in the proper way. When Locke comes along, and he's much more of what most modern people would think of, in that, well, the church and state, I mean, they're completely separate. They don't have anything to do with each other. They have goals that are really, they're not mutually exclusive, but they're just in separate spheres, and never the twain shall meet.
Mm-hmm. Now, he, in some ways, his academic nemesis, so to speak, was Thomas Hobbes, and I think part of this debate over what the role of government is in promoting virtue, or what the scope of government is, I should perhaps say, was different between these two individuals. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, Hobbes is writing about a generation before Locke, and his most famous work, called The Leviathan, is published in 1651. So Hobbes is writing this during the Civil War, as it was proceeding in the 1640s, and it's a massive book. It's much, much longer than Locke's second treatise on civil government. Hobbes and Locke both approach the question of the formation of government in a similar way, in that they both hypothesize, they speculate, that once upon a time, long, long ago, there was no government and people lived in this state of nature. And that's a phrase, a state of nature, that gets picked up and used by a lot of different people in the 17th and 18th centuries. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, for example, relied on this a great deal in his famous book, The Social Contract. But Hobbes and Locke postulate very different things about this state of nature. For Hobbes, the state of nature is just a free-for-all. Everybody has a right to everything. It's a constant state of war between among all human beings. Nobody has any security whatsoever. Everybody, as I said, has a right to everything. So, if you have something that I want, I can come and assault you to try to get it away from you, and I haven't violated your rights in any sense, because I have just as much right to that thing that you have that I want as you do. Now, Locke thought about the state of nature in a very different way. He comes up with an interesting theory about how people can acquire rights to things in the physical world, in nature. They can acquire property, and that's by, as he calls it, mixing your labor with something in nature. So, for example, if you and I, Tony, were out on a desert island, and you saw a tree with some bananas in it, and you climbed the tree because you were hungry and you picked a banana, you came down the tree, then Locke would say, you've mixed your labor with that banana. You've expended some effort. You worked to get it. It was a tree that nobody owned. It was just out there in nature, and you went and you did the work to get that banana. And so you have a property right in that banana. And so that if I came up and took a rock and bashed you on the head to get it, I'd be violating your rights. I'd be in the wrong then, whereas Hobbes would say, Jason has just as much right to that as Tony does, so there's no fault there. So they look at this in very different ways, and that affects how they come up with their theory of government. Hobbes says, well, everybody's so scared about this state of war, we're going to give up our rights to this sovereign who will then ensure law and order. That's the deal. The sovereign promises law and order, and then we just submit to him in everything. So he becomes this absolute ruler. Whereas Locke says, we can't give the ruler a right to everything. We can only cede to the sovereign rights that we already had ourselves as individuals. And since I don't have a right to take your property, Tony, I can't give to the sovereign a right to take your property either. And so under Locke's view of the government, there is much more of a sense of what we would call today, individual liberties, civil liberties, property rights. Everybody has property in himself. The civil magistrate cannot just go around doing whatever he wants to do. There are limits on his authority. He has to respect those boundaries. Whereas Hobbes is just, anything the sovereign does, even if we don't like it, we put up with it because the alternative would be chaos.
Yeah, and as Hobbes says, life is solitary, nasty, brutish, and short. And Locke seemed to have a little bit more sanguine view of human nature, I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and not that Locke thinks that, we're all naturally angels. In fact, the reason why Locke thought we needed a government is because people regularly violated, each other's rights. But this provided a way in which we could have a greater amount of security and still hold on to, our own rights in our physical bodies and in what we've justly acquired through nature, or either by homesteading, mixing our labor with nature, or in exchange with others, when we can have rights to that property.
Now, in terms of church and state relations, and we were talking a little bit about this earlier, Hobbes tended to be of the view, as I understand it, that it would be better for the government to regulate religious matters and just provide one religion or a very similar religious landscape for everybody to avoid that solitary, nasty, brutish, and short conflict. Is that reading correct?
Yeah, and Hobbes is actually, to a lot of people, he's kind of slippery on this. Hobbes was accused in his own day of being an atheist because of the way he lays out what he thinks the role of the government ought to be with religion, because he seemed to think that you could very easily get an impression from his writing that if you're the civil magistrate, if you're the king, your only interest in really is to maintain order, and so you just pick whatever religion is most conducive to that, and you just impose it on everybody, and then it ensures civil peace and that works. Now Hobbes himself, he says, I believe that in Christianity, I believe the scriptures are inspired, and people doubted his sincerity on that because of the way in which he framed this discussion of how the magistrate deals with religion. But these absolutists, and not only Hobbes, but there are several others in the 17th century who would take this view, would say that if the magistrate lays down a religion that you don't like, well, you follow your conscience to the extent that you may not be able to participate in those ceremonies and services that the magistrate enjoins on you, but then part of your being true to your conscience is that you just have to put up with whatever penalty is meted out to you as a result of that.
Yeah, kind of suck it up, kid.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And that, I think that brings us up to the letter concerning toleration. And again, you can kind of see these different views between Locke and Hobbes. As you mentioned, Hobbes was writing during the English Civil War, and that's it's a really messy time. People are getting killed, and there's lots of religious conflict, so you can kind of understand where Hobbes is going to step back and say, whoa, maybe we should ameliorate this conflict and let the civil magistrate kind of dictate what's going to be happening here. But Locke comes to a different conclusion here in his letter concerning toleration. Now, before we get to the content of that, I want to talk about the word letter. When I think about a letter, I think about something like, you know, dear mom, camp is fun, the food is terrible, having fun canoeing, love Johnny. And at most, that's going to take up maybe two or three pages if you're detailing everything that you did at camp. However, Locke's, quote, letter, unquote, runs basically 57, 58 pages. So you know, what's the deal there? Is he writing to somebody? That's why it's called a letter? Or is it just another name for a book back then?
Yeah, you got to wonder, you know, how much free time did these people have in the 17th century if their personal correspondence is running this long? But actually, you know, this is a fairly common convention in the early modern period where you say that this is a letter and you address it to a particular individual. And yeah, on one level, it is a letter, but you are not intending that the recipient of that letter, whose name is on it, to be the only person who's going to read this. You know that this is going to wind up being published, that there are going to be a lot of people reading it, and this is going to be a way for you to get your ideas out on some important topic of the day. So the publishing of correspondence was a very common thing back then, and this is how a lot of academics or public intellectuals would get their ideas out there.
It's kind of like blogging, like the Western tradition.
Yeah, in a way, I guess you could say that.
Okay. We will link to your blog, and you could start calling it the Letters of Western Tradition. Start writing 58-page tomes, I guess. I don't know, but no, your writings are actually very pithy and to the point, which is one of the reasons I love the blog that you run.
I appreciate that, but it's really a time thing. I certainly wouldn't have time to sit down and write 57 or 58 pages on one particular topic.
Yeah, no, that's true. They didn't have football back then. My writing always tends to go down during football season. And so, you know, Locke, what else do you do if you don't have football on? You write 58-page letters about toleration. So what is the main points of Locke's letter concerning toleration?
Locke is also, from what would have been called at that time sort of a nonconformist persuasion. After the Restoration, if you were a Protestant but you did not attend services in the Church of England, which had been abolished, by the way, during the
Cromwell's reign.
They reestablished the Church of England. They bring back the bishops and all of that, and there are a lot of ministers who were upset with this, who basically get thrown out of their positions in the early 1660s. But these Protestants who disagreed with the reimposition or reestablishment of the Church of England were called nonconformists. Now, they are a fairly small minority. It's estimated that in the 1660s, 70s, probably 90% or more of the people in England conformed to the official church. So this is a fairly small percentage, less than 10% certainly, because you've also got 2 or 3 percentage points who are Catholics at that time, plus a smattering of Jews and maybe some other people there. But we have a lot of the really interesting writing to modern people and interesting ideas coming out of this nonconformist camp. Not just Locke, but a lot of other writers such as the Puritan author John Owen and so forth, who are still studied quite a bit today. You also have the author of The Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan, who was one of the, of course, Pilgrim's Progress is one of the most read books in the English language over the last 300 years. So, this is, the nonconformists are responsible for a lot of the kind of religious energy of this period. So Locke is writing this letter and saying, look, at the very least, for the Protestants who don't feel comfortable with going to the Church of England, they should not be persecuted. And when he says persecution, we're not throwing people onto the rack or anything like that. This is not the Spanish Inquisition or anything of that sort. But there are certain penalties that could be assessed. I mean, you might be fined. There might be some other sort of penalty assigned to you, particularly if you were a minister in one of these nonconformist churches. So Locke is saying, okay, look, number one, what's the point of this? I mean, do you really think that you're going to bring people to what you consider to be the true faith by coercing them in this way? This is, I think, one of the best arguments that Locke makes in that he's saying, you know, you don't change people's minds by, you know, putting some kind of penalty on them like this. If you really want them to come to faith, and, you know, after all, you know, if you're not really persuaded of something, it's not going to do you any good in terms of religion.
Mm-hmm.
How can you do that by simply, you know, bringing the power, the coercive power of the state to bear here instead of using reason, persuasion, you know, other kinds of peaceful means to try to bring people around to your point of view? Okay, so that's one of the major points that Locke is saying. Now, he does not address the question, which I think is a kind of a, I don't know if whether it was an intentional thing on his part, but, you know, one of the historic arguments in favor of some kind of religious persecution is that if we don't, you know, nip this heresy or whatever it might be in the bud, you know, it could spread and it'd be like a, you know, an infectious disease. You know, other people are kind of taken in by this, and before you know it, you've got souls being lost because of this heresy that was allowed to run rampant.
Or atheism, too, because, I mean, I'm thinking about this in terms of, you know, your teenage kids, that you have to coerce them to go to church because they naturally won't do that. And it's the view of government in a paternalistic fashion is saying, well, if we allow people to naturally go toward their faith or to naturally choose their faith, they aren't going to choose it because they're too lazy.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And Locke, I think, you know, in his second treatise, he talks about this question of particularly young people and saying that, well, you know, your teenage son, he doesn't really fully partake of the rational faculty yet.
Yeah.
So up until that point where you can truly say, you know, this is a reasonable individual, you know, up until then, parents in particular are justified in using coercion to get them to do the things that they ought to do. Now, once they reach whatever that age might be, and Locke is not really specific on, you know, when that is, but he says, you know, once they've matured and they've fully developed the rational faculty, then it would be inappropriate to try to use coercion in any way.
And I agree with you here, too. This is one of the more interesting aspects of Locke's treatise, or his letter, excuse me, and he starts this off by saying, listen, you can't coerce people to faith. You have to really come to it. I kind of read a little bit of a born-again aspect into Locke's thinking there. I don't think he specifically used that term till I can remember, but it has this Calvinist Baptist flavor to it that says, listen, you know, your faith is not given to you by a civil magistrate or being born into a nation. You have to find your salvation.
Yeah, he does drop several lines in the letter that sort of hint at that. He never just comes out and says it explicitly, but I think you're on the right track there. And he also, I thought, made a good point in saying, you know, look at the people who are doing this. You know, what's their real motivation here? I mean, are we really supposed to think that they believe that, you know, they're being motivated out of Christian charity and all this by coming in and, you know, and coercing these people? I think he does a pretty good job of kind of calling in question the motives of some of the people who are engaged in this.
And I think you're right there that, you know, in many ways pointing the fingers of hypocrisy that, you know, once you get control of a state church, you want to promote virtue in society, but man, that can be used for a lot of different things to consolidate your power. And, you know, as we're talking about this Locke guy is a little bit concerned about centralized power and violations of liberties by a central power. I guess that brings us to the relationship of church and state here. And that's a big issue within this letter concerning toleration. So what is his thinking on the relationship between church and state?
Well, I sort of hinted at it earlier when I said that, you know, in Locke's view, the church is there for public worship and to help the members of that church or congregation figure out how to get to heaven. And that's pretty much all the church is. I mean, at least that's how he lays it out in the letter. Now, whether he actually, you know, believed that, he took that to its logical conclusion, I don't know. But he sets it up in such a way that really, the church, that's just what goes on inside the four walls of the building on Sunday morning. And then the state is, you know, doing something completely different. It's just there, like I said earlier, to provide physical security and to make sure that we all get what he calls these civil goods. safety and the ability to accumulate property and those kinds of things. So he sets this lack of relationship up and say, really, they don't have anything to do with each other. And so if that's true, then, yeah, it wouldn't be appropriate for the civil magistrate to come in and try to start messing around with what's going on inside the four walls of the church building on Sunday morning. Now, as I said, that's to a lot of people, that would have been a revolutionary definition of what these two institutions are and what they're supposed to do, because historically you have much more of the sense of the church and the state have kind of overlapping missions and they should be cooperating in pursuit of those missions and that kind of thing.
When I come to think about this, let me step back a little bit and talk about the issue of toleration, because this is a letter concerning toleration. We're just talking about church and state here. And if you separate church and state and allow the multiplicity of religions to flourish, and this is something that Hobbes was talking about earlier, so this could just lead to total chaos. I mean, you know, Locke, if Hobbes was still around at the time when he was writing, and I think Hobbes was dead, he probably would have turned to Locke and said, dude, you know, all these people are going to kill one another. And then if you fast forward to, you know, the 20th century, the 21st century, you take a look at India, you know, you got Hindus and Muslims killing one another and then persecuting Christians. Wouldn't it just be better if India was all just one uniform formity? So how does Locke deal with this issue of whether or not different denominations, different sects are going to fight with one another?
Well, I think that he is... he's able to an extent, given the time in which he's writing, he's able to take for granted that there's a broad consensus in the society that, we should be pursuing Christian goods in the sense of, the good life. That, yes, we need physical security, but we also are going to agree that we need a healthy public environment in which it's possible for people to practice the Christian virtues and those sorts of things. So even though we've got different sects here, we've got, the Church of England, and we've got Presbyterians, and then we've got some of these Congregationalists and other groups out there who are doing different things, and they do different things inside their church buildings on Sunday, but still he's able to kind of fall back on this, that we differ on, but when it comes to the public square and what's going on in society, still there's a lot of consensus. So he doesn't really have to confront a lot of those kinds of questions like you're bringing up. Well, what do you do in India with Hindus and Muslims and whoever else? Or what do you do when you've got a Christian minority in an Islamic state? Or any of those kinds of questions where you have really, in a lot of ways, fundamentally different faiths that are kind of competing with each other, not only on what happens in worship services, but also just the general tenor of the society and the public square.
So it seems like he's really relying on the better angels of individuals to all get along with one another.
Yeah, and again, given his context, he might have had a reasonable basis for doing that, because I think he would have been shocked if somebody were to come along and to suggest that society ought to countenance some of the things that are proposed to us in the 21st century, whether it's gay marriage or whatever it might be. I wonder how the limits to which Locke would say, yeah, let's just live and let live. I mean, it's hard to tell, of course, for a guy living in the 17th century, how he might respond to that. But I have to think that he would at the very least go back and say, well, maybe I took something for granted here that I shouldn't have.
Yeah. Well, talk about that live and let live attitude, because he has that attitude. But on the other hand, there's these other folks there that are Christians, but they're called Catholics. And how does Locke view these folks?
Yeah, he's suspicious of Catholics, which is not at all surprising in England in the 17th century. As I said earlier, when Oliver Cromwell comes up and says, hey, we're going to have religious toleration, he says, well, we're going to have religious toleration for Protestants.
Yeah.
He doesn't allow the Catholics to have free practice of their faith either. And to the 17th century mind, at least, this is to a great extent motivated by the thinking that, Catholics have declared allegiance to a foreign power. They've declared allegiance to the Pope, and according to the Catholic teaching, at least in the minds of the Protestants, that allegiance to the Pope is going to trump their loyalty to, the English king or to, any other thing that we've got going on in society. So there's always this kind of wild card. Anytime the Pope goes off the reservation, so to speak, we could have all kinds of, he could say the word and the Catholics would be, up in arms and causing all kinds of civil unrest. And you see this a lot in the writings and the pamphlet literature and all that in the 17th century, a real fear that if Catholics are allowed to practice openly, that they'll be the sort of like this fifth column inside the country. And you saw that even in the United States, as you're well aware, as recently as the 1960 presidential election, one of the objections to Kennedy was, well, he's a Catholic. What's he going to do when the Pope tells him to do something that's contrary to American tradition or American ideals or whatever?
Yeah. No, I'm even thinking about in the 1680s, and I remember as being of Irish heritage and having an Irish Catholic background, we're always kind of bitter that during the Glorious Revolution, one of the rights granted to citizens was the right to bear arms, unless you were an Irish Catholic, and so that always kind of, peeved some of us Irish Catholic folks. And it does, all of this discussion, though, in situating Locke really does tell us about some of the boundaries of tolerance that, you look at Locke and say, oh, man, what a tolerant guy up to this point.
Right. And with the Catholics, I mean, he doesn't explicitly say it just flat out, but you certainly get the impression that he would not object to continuing restrictions being placed on Catholics. He says near the end of the letter, flat out, I mean, we cannot allow toleration to atheists. If we have atheists, we have nothing to rest on. I mean, we have nothing in common with them in the sense that we can't count on any kind of ethical restraint from them. They are going to be loose cannons in the society. There's nothing to stop them from, engaging in all kinds of criminal or antisocial behavior. And that's sort of the impression that you get from the latter part of his letter. But yeah, you're right that the Locke definitely is not just kind of throwing the doors wide open in the sense that a lot of 21st century people would like to do and just say, whatever floats your boat. Locke is saying, well, we still do need to have something to rest our social cohesion upon, and atheism is going beyond those bounds.
And you do see this, older debate that we were talking about earlier seep into Locke's thinking too, that the state, the old medieval philosophy that the state is supposed to promote virtue, and Locke is reacting against this. No, they're just supposed to do the, the physical here and now worldly kind of stuff. But as you mentioned with the atheists, he says, well, we still do have to have the regulation of atheism. You can't have that. So you can see that he's pretty much wrestling with this tension. He's probably at an interesting point in history where he does have to wrestle with that.
Yeah, and there's a real shift going on here in the 17th and the 18th centuries. When we've come off this century of religious warfare, throughout the Middle Ages, the whole social theory was that, well, Christianity is what ties society together. That's sort of how we define who we are and what our obligations are to each other, both in terms of individuals and also social classes and those sorts of things. And that understanding is being eroded here in the 17th and 18th centuries. And they say, well, we can't agree on this religion thing because we've got Catholics and Protestants and we've had all this bloodshed over it. So let's see if we can figure out something else. And so you start seeing all this discussion in the 17th and 18th centuries of having a civil religion. And how can we come up with sort of a lowest common denominator that will allow us all to maintain, order in the polity without, sparking all of these, disagreements among the various religious persuasions? Locke is sort of, having to deal with that a little bit. But, I think this is one of the fundamental problems of, modern society. I ask my undergraduate students here at Faulkner, I say, so what if you say you're an American, what does that mean? What's the thing that ties all Americans together? And they really have a hard time coming up with an answer to that question, other than just the pure geographical fact of where you happen to have been born, because throughout their lives they're told celebrate diversity and all this sort of thing, and that almost gets to the point where you're saying, well, the thing that binds us, the thing that we all have in common, is that we have nothing in common. If diversity is the thing, you know. So I think that we have, that's one of the problems of modern society. We don't really know how to answer that question about what's the basis of social cohesion, the basis of social unity. You know, the medievals had an answer to that. They said it was Christianity. Now, you know, we don't really have as much. Do you have an answer to that, Tony? I'd love to be able to tell my students.
No, I don't. It is one of these paradoxical things, too. And given that I have a tend to have a more libertarian bent to my philosophy, it is something that you wrestle with, because, you know, pure libertine anarchy is probably not a world that I want to live in. So, you know, to what extent can that function in a society? It has to be tied together by some source of cohesion, and what is that? That's a tough question.
Yeah, and, you know, other societies, they say, well, you know, we have a common ethnicity, or, you know, heritage, or whatever. I mean, other societies have come up with that answer in different ways, but all those traditional answers, it seems, are sort of out of bounds in the you know, the postmodern multicultural atmosphere that we're operating in.
Yeah, we're a largely immigrant country, too. So to root your commonality on a specific geography or a specific language becomes impossible.
Yeah, and we have, you know, throughout a lot of the 20th century, I think, sort of the tacit understanding of our social unity, at least in the United States, was that, well, we can all make money off of each other. You know, material prosperity is the thing that, you know, we have this continuing economic growth, and we're all doing kind of well. And then when you hit, a serious recession like we've had the last few years, then that too starts to come under question, and people start to say, well, you know, we're not getting out of this, you know, what we thought we were going to get out of this, is this whole participation in society, and there are winners and losers, and then people start to have all kinds of problems with that too. So that might not be an answer that will sustain us going forward either.
Let me ask you this, because we received a question on our Facebook page from one of our regular listeners, Professor Ruth Arnell at BYU Idaho. And this relates to this issue of to what extent are we bound together. And in the current presidential campaign season, we see Mitt Romney being one of the front runners in the Republican party for the nomination to be president, and he's a Mormon. And this has freaked out a number of evangelicals, some of them who have come out explicitly and says, I will never vote for a Mormon, and it gets to the issue of that cohesion. So, you know, Professor Ruth Arnold actually wanted us to ask this question of what would Locke have to say about Mormons in contemporary U.S. society, if he was transported here, would it be the same thing as he said about Catholics, or is there something different here? Go ahead and speculate on that.
I think that the analogy would rest on whether he would view the prophet of Mormonism as sort of analogous to the Pope. That if he thought that the prophet could you know, have a bolt from the blue, or, you know, play some kind of wild card that would tend to undermine the relationship between Mormons and the rest of the people in the society, then I think he might ask or countenance some kind of restrictions on them. If he were convinced that you know, there was no possibility there was going to be some kind of new revelation or something like that, or some directive that goes out from you know, from Utah or wherever, that's going to turn the Mormons against their fellow Americans. If his fears were set at ease in that respect, I would think that he would view, even if he viewed Mormonism as a sort of a non-Christian religion, that he would probably class it in the same category as Muslims or pagans and other people that he explicitly says in the letter and in its sequels that we should tolerate.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting question to speculate on, because, you know, I'm a big fan of Locke, but, you know, often there's these tensions in here that sometimes difficult to resolve. And one of the things that you wrote on your blog, The Western Tradition, which again we will be linking to, is you finish your blog post on Locke by saying that you don't think Locke's argument is as ironclad as most people make it out to be. Explain that.
Well, I sort of went back to the foundation of his argument, and this is something that I ran into with the Second Treatise as well. If you accept Locke's first principles and his definitions, you know, his arguments are very sound. You know, if you are with him at the starting point, he kind of leads you step by step to the conclusion where he wants you to be. But where a lot of people have come out against Locke is that they'll say, well, you know, his first principles are just wrong. And so if those definitions, like he offers, of what the church is, what the state is, what they're supposed to do, if you don't agree with Locke on the function of the church, if it's not just a what he calls a voluntary association that is there for the public worship of God, then, yeah, you might not be persuaded by the rest of his argument. And I think this is one of these situations where a lot of people, you know of the letter concerning toleration and of the influence that it's had, but they haven't actually gone and read it all the way through. You know, just a few weeks ago was the first time that I really sat down and read the entire thing and said, okay, yeah, given these first principles, yes, it's a good argument, but if you don't accept that, you've got a problem. And we have a lot of people who would say, I was just reading an article, I can't remember the author, just in the last couple of days, who said, you know, these great champions of religious toleration, the great arguments for religious toleration, he cited Locke as one of them. And I had to wonder, has this person actually read Locke, or does he just know that he wrote this important work on toleration? And, you know, we do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. We've kind of say, well, so-and-so must have proved this point, therefore I don't really have to think through it myself necessarily.
I will admit to being guilty on that front too, because as I've written a book on religious liberty and focusing a chapter of it on the colonial period, you know, I reference Locke. I said, you know, Locke is this guy who influenced the thought of Madison and, you know, some of the other founding fathers. And I had never really sat down and had read through a lot of Locke's writings. I remember doing it in college. By my own admission, I'm not very good at political philosophy. So there is this tendency to ascribe to Locke what other people have said to him. And I think we get a little bit lazy on this. You know, part of my argument, though, is that I'm not so sure how influential intellectuals are when it comes to actually coming up with practical policy. I tend to be a little bit more skeptical on that. I think as intellectuals, and we write about intellectuals, we tend to over-inflate that a bit. And my thesis on religious liberty was a little bit more motivated by self-interest rather than the influence of Locke. But I want you to speak to that. To what extent do you think Locke really had a big influence on Western civilization?
I think one of the good examples of that kind of skepticism on the role of intellectuals that you're talking about is you just look at the Declaration of Independence. You know, everybody knows the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, the part that apparently it looks like Locke might have influenced with his language of, you know, life and liberty and so on. But, you know, the first two paragraphs, the thing that everybody quotes, that's really more or less like a preamble. You know, like mm-hmm. You look at the meat of the Declaration of Independence, and it was all of these, you know, real world, at the moment, grievances that were getting these people, you know, all upset. And I think that some people like Locke and other, you know, intellectuals might help to sort of create an intellectual climate in which people think. They might, you know, have an kind of unconscious influence in that way. But when it comes to, you know, nobody is going to say, well, let's start out to make a new country and let's read Locke to figure out how to do it. You know, I'm with you in that I don't think that really happens. I mean, the people are motivated by the, you know, the immediate concerns that are facing them on a day-to-day basis to a great extent, and they meet those in more or less an ad hoc manner. And if they can go to somebody like Locke and find some ammunition to help them in that particular fight, they'll do it. But that's a very different thing from saying that, well, Locke, you know, influenced this person to go out and do this thing that he wouldn't otherwise have done.
Well, you know, that brings us to the end of our podcast here, and it's an interesting thought, and I'm glad we both concur on that, because I often debate folks who are in the humanities, and you are the chair of the humanities at Faulkner University, who really tell me about the importance of intellectuals and how much intellectual ideas are worth in the construction of policy. So I'm glad we agree upon that. But nonetheless,
let me add one thing. I don't think we should underestimate the importance of the kind of the climate that's created by intellectuals. I mean, and it's, you know, it's often something that you might not be able to measure. You know, if it's sort of like, well, somebody watches TV for, you know, 20 hours a week for 10 years, and probably there's going to be some influences on their thought on all the kinds of stuff that they were watching all that time, but it would be a lot harder to point to somebody and say, okay, this document or this particular person, that's the smoking gun. You know, but, you know, we were influenced in a lot of different ways in culture, and, you know, intellectuals are, you know, one part of that. They help to, they're an ingredient in that recipe. I'll just leave it at that.
I think that's true. And that does actually make me feel better, because it is my own profession to be an intellectual and to come up with ideas and hope that these ideas influence other people. So I have to wrestle with my skepticism to what extent intellectuals can influence other individuals, how our ideas are taken by others and used by others, you know, with the fact that I do want my ideas to be influential. And that, at the conclusion here, it brings me to your blog, where you are, you know, propagating a number of your ideas, as well as ideas about the great books of Western civilization. And again, that blog is called The Western Tradition. What are you trying to do with that, and with your series? You kind of are running through a series of reading the great books of Western civilization. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think our listeners would be very interested to visit that.
I've gotten involved in the last few years here at Falcon with working with graduate students, many of whom are, you know, not here in Montgomery. We have some distance programs that we've got up and running in the last couple of years, and I thought that one of the good ways to interact with those students and with anybody else who might be out there is to have a blog. And so I started poking around with this really 3 or 4 years ago, but it was only about a year and a half ago that I decided I was going to really try to do something with it and accomplish something. And one of the projects that I came up with was this thing of reading through the Great Books of the Western World series, the thing that was originally put out in the 50s by Mortimer Adler was the lead editor on that. But it was a compilation of you know, many of the you know, central works in the Western intellectual tradition, going all the way back to the Greeks and coming up to the 20th century. And since I teach in a Great Books program here, I thought that would also give me some, you know, professional development that would be very useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I've set out a schedule for myself and said I'll take 7 years to do it. So I figured out roughly how much I'd have to read every week to get through that, and I'm tracking what I do on the blog. I make at least one post every week on the blog dealing with this Great Books reading project, and it's coming out to a little over 100 pages a week typically, but the Great Books set, I mean, it's in very small typeset and double columns, and you mentioned that your edition of Locke's letter was 57 pages.
Yeah.
It's only 22 pages in my edition.
Oh, that's got to be really small font.
So it may be something like 200 plus pages every week. But it's been a really great journey for me. I'm nearing the end of the first year of it. I've read over 5,000 pages so far, and it's been I've had exposure to, you know, a lot of the things I'd read before, but many of them, particularly some of the scientific and philosophical works, I had never looked at, and I'm getting a lot out of that. I'm sure that it's improving my own teaching, but also giving me more of a chance to you know think through some of these questions, like religious toleration, you know, things that I've had assumptions about for a long time, and now reading some of these works, thinking, well, maybe I missed something here. Maybe I need to go back and figure this out for myself, and I think that's going to make me a better person, and anyone else who wants to join in that conversation, you know, I'd welcome participation on the blog. Or I don't remember exactly when you discovered the Western tradition. It might have been after I said something about your podcast on my blog, but
yeah, and that was the case. So, you know, folks, if you mention Research on Religion on your blog or on your Facebook page or website, I find you, and good things happen from that.
Yeah, you know, so it's been a great experience in that I'm making contact with other like-minded people who see the value of some of these things.
No, it's great, yeah.
And I got invited on to Research on Religion, so, you know, I could die happy.
That's great. Well, I have to ask the question, in your Great Book series, is The Political Origins of Religious Liberty considered one of the canons of Western civilization?
That hasn't been on the reading list up until this point, but if you want to, you know, send me the justification for why we might want to put it on there next semester, I'll think
okay.
about it.
Okay. I might think about it. In fact, I have to make the announcement that my press just told me that there's going to be an Arabic translation of my book too. So I'm expanding from Western civilization into the East now as well, or to the Middle East, I guess.
Congratulations.
Yeah, no, very excited about it. And I'm also very excited to have you on our podcast today. We've been talking with Jason Jewell, who is the chair of the Department of Humanities at Faulkner University and runs an incredibly insightful and wonderful blog called The Western Tradition, which I think you all should visit. And Jason, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.